Manhattan, not far from the New York Public Library, Novo has made empowering women and girls, particularly those of color, its primary cause. Peter has explained how this focus came about. When he and Jennifer started Novo, they weren't fixated on specific issues, as many philanthropists are. Rather, they were driven by a few basic instincts. One was a desire to avoid what Peter called philanthropic colonialism, which he described in his memoir, Life is What You Make It, as the tendency of well-meaning outsiders to imagine that they understand the challenges facing local peoples better than the local people themselves. Peter and Jennifer wanted to do things differently. Our approach would be to provide support for people who identified their own needs and evolved their own solutions. A second idea was to challenge a world based in domination and exploitation and help move it to a world of collaboration and partnership. That led the couple to think about what we would call feminine values, said Peter, where the focus is less on power over and more on power with and collaboration. More concretely, as the Buffetts talk to experts in philanthropy and beyond, trying to sort out their giving priorities, they came to see that empowering girls and women had all sorts of multiplier effects in terms of changing how communities and entire national economies worked. Warren Buffett has made his fortune by investing in undervalued assets, and Peter came to think of the world's female population in this light. He said, "If their voices aren't heard, of course you're missing half the population, but more importantly, when you support them, they support their families and their communities, and it starts to transform how the world is taken care of." By 2016, the Novo Foundation was one of the top U.S. funders for gender equity. This is also a focus of the much larger Susan Thompson Buffett Foundation, which is based in Omaha and chaired by daughter Susie. In 2014, the foundation gave out $416 million in grants, nearly all of it to further sexual and reproductive health and rights. Just a decade earlier, it gave out a fraction of that amount, a testament to how quickly new philanthropic powerhouses can emerge these days, pouring game-changing amounts of money into certain issues. The Buffett Foundation remains a top supporter of Planned Parenthood and other groups that back abortion access, as it was when the senior Susie ran it. Yet now it's writing even bigger checks. One of its largest impacts has been around contraception, where the foundation has played a key role in battling unwanted pregnancies by helping bankroll new birth control options. Its grants have helped revolutionize the use of IUDs, a long-acting form of contraception. A reason that IUDs are so effective is because once these tiny, T-shaped devices are inserted into the uterus, there's no room for user error. The Buffett Foundation invested heavily both in research to improve IUDs and programs to spread their use. Quietly, steadily, the Buffett family is funding the biggest shift in birth control in a generation, according to one media account. In the United States, more than half of pregnancies are unintended, some 3 million such surprises every year, with poorer women most likely to get accidentally pregnant. Around 1.5 million births result from these pregnancies annually, with most of the costs covered by Medicaid. Yet, while Medicaid picks up the tab for unplanned births, government funding for contraception is in short supply, especially in certain states where religious conservatives wield influence or fiscal pressures are mounting. The Buffett Foundation has often stepped in to make a difference. One foundation-backed effort to provide long-acting birth control to teenagers in Colorado helped lower the birth rate among teenagers across the state by a stunning 40% from 2009 to 2013, and sharply cut the number of abortions, too. Despite this success, the Colorado legislature refused to provide ongoing funding for the program, at which point a group of private funders stepped in to ensure it would continue, including Ben Walton, an heir to the Walmart fortune who lives in Denver. Buffett funds don't just make contraception more widely available. This cash is also crucial to ensuring that abortions are accessible in many places in the United States. The foundation is the single largest funder, by far, of the National Abortion Federation, NAF, the Professional Association of Abortion Providers. It's given the group tens of millions of dollars in recent years, money that, among other things, helps train doctors to perform abortions, a skill no longer taught at most medical schools. In 2014, it gave the group $23 million to support its national telephone hotline, which NAF describes as the only toll-free source of information about abortion and referrals to providers of quality care in the U.S. and Canada. Other big checks have gone to an array of pro-choice groups that are deep in the policy fights over abortion access, like the National Abortion Rights Action League, NARAL, and the National Women's Law Center. Meanwhile, the Buffett Foundation is also the single largest private funder of family planning services at an international level. Much of this money finds its way to distant parts of the world, where women are battling not just for control over their reproductive choices, but for a range of basic rights. One of its biggest grantees, IPAS, is the global equivalent of NAF, advocating for abortion rights while training providers in numerous countries, especially in Africa, where some 6 million unsafe abortions occur every year, killing nearly 30,000 women. IPAS has pulled in nearly $150 million in grants from the Buffett Foundation in the past decade. In recent years, the Buffett Foundation's giving has grown steadily as it absorbed an influx of ever more valuable Berkshire Hathaway stock, an influx that promises to continue for years to come, bestowing billions on this institution and allowing it to expand its push for reproductive rights. How many people know that one of America's richest men is pouring a fortune into one of the world's most contested issues? Not many. Howard's Crusade. Even less well known is how Buffett money is being used to fight hunger worldwide, as well as the conditions that lead to hunger, like war and political instability. Those are the priorities of Howard Buffett, whose foundation has lately been giving away upwards of $175 million a year, often backing ambitious and risky projects in sub-Saharan Africa. Like his two siblings, Howard attended integrated public schools in Omaha growing up, and like both of them, he never finished college, a fact that didn't bother his parents, who had always told their children to chart their own path. In an affectionate foreword to Howard's memoir, 40 Chances, Warren joked of his kids, "If the three combined their college credit, they would be entitled to one degree that they could rotate among themselves." That book, published in 2013, explains Howard's unusual life choices. He became a farmer in his 20s, eventually owning 1,500 acres in central Illinois. This experience led him to be keenly aware of the challenge of producing enough food for an ever more populous world, especially in places with poor soil or a lack of water. Buffett visited many such places after he took up wildlife photography and traveled the world taking pictures of exotic animals. He came to see how widespread hunger and malnutrition were in many places, especially Africa, where he traveled extensively, often to remote corners of little-known countries. When Warren Buffett began shoveling big chunks of Berkshire Hathaway stock into Howard's foundation after 2006, Howard moved to tackle food issues on a large scale. Buffett strongly embraces his father's adage that philanthropy is society's risk capital. He told me Warren passed along huge wealth with exactly that attitude, saying, "You go take risks. You try to do things. You can fail as many times as you need to fail to get to some of those big wins." Howard estimates that he'll give away a total of $8 billion before his foundation shuts its doors in 2045. That's a lot of risk capital to work with. Howard and his small staff have bankrolled projects in Africa, Latin America, and South Asia, getting behind local efforts to help farmers boost their yields and incomes. The foundation is making its biggest investment in Rwanda, where it's putting up $500 million for a push to transform that country's agricultural sector in ways that can serve as a model for the rest of Africa. Buffett has also created three research farms to explore how to raise crop productivity in adverse settings. One is in Arizona, another is in South Africa. Not everything he's tried has worked out so well. I'm sure we have more failures than we have successes, Buffett said, and that doesn't bother me. We've tried to do things in a lot of difficult places, and we've tried to do a lot of new things. That's the whole point of philanthropy as he sees it. Buffett told me, it's the private foundations in the world that should take risks. We don't have to stand up at our annual gala events to show our successes because we need more people to write checks. Warren has said that, as a small child, Howard was a force of nature, a tiny perpetual motion machine, and that he grew up to have boundless energy, operating on only one speed, fast forward. As a philanthropist, Howard has given away huge amounts of money with just a few staff to help him, operating in a very hands-on way. I go charging ahead. I want to go see stuff, look at stuff, and try to figure it out. He estimates that he's been to 130 countries. No part of the world has preoccupied him more than the Great Lakes region of Africa. That spectacular area includes two of the biggest lakes in the world, Victoria and Tanganyika, along with some of its greatest biodiversity. It's also home to three deeply troubled countries, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, and Burundi. In his work on agriculture in the region, Buffett came to see just how important peace and stability are to ensuring food supplies and preventing hunger. When farmers are driven from their land by warlords or can't get their crops to market because of conflict, people go unfed. And so it was that Buffett became involved in trying to stop the cycle of brutal conflicts in eastern Congo, where multiple armies have been fighting since the 1990s in wars that have claimed 5 million lives. This effort has taken different forms, including supporting efforts to stop poaching in the beautiful Virunga National Park, where rebels slaughtered elephants and sold the ivory to buy arms and supplies. The Howard Buffett Foundation gave funds to the park's courageous director, Emmanuel de Merode, to build up a stronger force of rangers, helping bolster a small army that goes up against armed poachers. Buffett also helped fund the hunt for Joseph Kony, the notorious Ugandan leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA, which is known for kidnapping children and for its psychopathic brutality. Black market ivory is among its chief sources of revenue. Buffett knew the LRA all too well. His foundation had made grants for work to undo Kony's damage by reintegrating child soldiers, counseling rape victims, and more. After consulting with lawyers, Buffett gave money to support helicopters and planes searching for the LRA. He even spent a night at the forward base in the Central African Republic. Buffett would tell the New Yorker about backing the Kony hunt. Why would you not jump at the chance to stop the core problem? If I can spend my money stopping it, so I don't have to spend more money in the future on the victims. Smart philanthropists often think this way, casting an eye upstream to where problems get started. While Buffett's giving can seem chaotic and impulsive at times, he's also a strategic thinker. He wants to fund permanent solutions that stick, not to just keep reapplying band-aids. After years of watching recurrent warfare in the eastern Congo, Buffett had come to the conclusion that most of what NGOs were doing in the region wasn't getting at the underlying causes of conflict. Relief projects didn't deal with a key problem, which was that a lot of men had no other livelihoods beyond warfare. The missing piece was you couldn't reintegrate people because there were no jobs. There was no magnet pulling fighters into more productive endeavors. We felt we needed to do something different, Buffett said. You've got to provide the jobs, provide alternatives to what people are doing today. The quest for a breakthrough led Buffett to bet big on building hydroelectric plants in the Great Lakes region. Electricity, Buffett knew, is an important driver of prosperity. It provides the power to establish businesses. And so the foundation undertook a pilot project, financing a small hydroelectric plant in Congo. Sure enough, after the new electricity was flowing, two new businesses popped up, one of them making soap that eventually came to employ hundreds of people. Buffett decided to double down, next backing a larger hydroelectric plant in North Kivu, in eastern Congo, that would cost $20 million and provide power to 130,000 people. Another benefit he saw from this electricity, beyond powering businesses, is that it would reduce the number of trees that people had to cut down in Virunga National Park to make charcoal for cooking. That activity didn't just hurt the forest. It helped rebel groups who often forced charcoal harvesters to pay a tax to them. Buffett saw how a new, bigger power plant could have a very far-reaching impact in terms of a single project. That's what sold us on it. The plan was for the Howard Buffett Foundation to put up half the cost of the new plant, with other partners laying out the rest. After those partners pulled out, Buffett still went forward. He and his staff also did a feasibility study of funding 6 more power plants in the area. The study found that 800 to 1,000 jobs would be created for each new megawatt of electricity. That seemed like a bargain to Buffett, who had enough money to actually back an effort on this scale and saw growing hope that economic development could eventually crowd out conflict in eastern Congo. Yet, he always knew that things could go wrong. "It's a huge bet," he said of the power plants. "It's also a really big risk. There's a lot that can go wrong. We're doing this in the middle of active conflict." But the alternative, doing the same things NGOs had always been doing, was a dead end. This wasn't the time to play it safe, as many funders prefer to do. "The risk doesn't faze me in terms of what we're trying to do. If you don't do something different, nothing's going to change." As for the standard metrics of success that foundations obsess over, Buffett said to forget them all. "You really can't set up metrics in a conflict zone. Everything changes all the time. The goalposts change, the players change. If we sat back and tried to analyze these on a set of metrics, we would never do the project." The new hydroelectric plant opened in December 2015. Buffett pledged nearly $40 million to build 2 more such plants in North Kivu. Not far from the tree. Not every billionaire has kids ready to put the family fortune to good use. Some children of top philanthropists aren't keen on carrying on their giving. Eli Broad, who is in his 80s with a $7 billion fortune to dispose of, told me that neither of his children was interested in one day piloting the Broad philanthropic operation. The foundation instead will spend down and close within 15 or 20 years of Broad's death. Gordon Moore's sons sit on the board of his foundation, but neither has emerged as a very active figure in philanthropy. Some billionaires like David Geffen and Paul Allen don't have any heirs. Other families, though, are more like the Buffetts, with the next generation eagerly taking on the job of large-scale philanthropy. 3 out of 4 of George Soros's kids back different causes and sit on the board of the Open Society Foundations. His daughter Andrea has focused on Tibet and global development issues. His son Jonathan has pushed to reform the campaign finance system. The youngest son, Alexander, has taken up human rights and other challenges facing marginalized peoples. Jim Simons's 3 kids are even further along in their own giving. Pete Peterson's son, Michael, is the president and CEO of the foundation named after his father. He's led the foundation's influential work on fiscal policy, and in years to come, is sure to be a key figure in giving away many hundreds of millions of dollars that his father has pledged to philanthropy. Sherry Redstone, the daughter of the media mogul Sumner Redstone, has played a central role in that family's philanthropy and is set to play an even bigger role down the line. Dave Peary is now piloting the Silicon Valley Foundation set up by his billionaire parents with their real estate fortune, just as Lisa Sobrato Sansini, the daughter of another Bay Area real estate billionaire, John Sobrato, has been a driving force in scaling up her family's philanthropy over the past 18 years. The list could go on. Probably no heirs in America wield as much influence as the Walton family, which still has a dominant ownership stake in Walmart, the largest private employer in the United States. Arguably, though, these heirs wield nearly as much clout through the family's foundation, which has nearly $3 billion in assets and gave out $374.7 million in 2015 alone, with the largest share of that money going to reshape America's K-12 system. The foundation has a professional staff, but its board is controlled by family members. Among them is board chair Kerry Walton Penner, a third-generation Walton who has long been a major player in the Foundation's K-12 giving. Penner has a profile similar to that of other heiresses who've groomed themselves for leadership in philanthropy, like Catherine Lorenz and Emma Bloomberg. After graduating from prep school in 1988, Penner went to Georgetown University, where she studied economics and history. At college, she volunteered to tutor high school students in Anacostia, a poor neighborhood of Washington, D.C. She found the experience deeply disturbing. "I have no idea why they were going to school at all, because, frankly, they weren't being educated," she later said. By the mid-1990s, Penner was immersed in education issues and finished her master's degree in education policy and program evaluation at Stanford University. Afterward, she served as a program officer at the Walton Family Foundation, among other jobs working on education. Penner is more than a funder of the school choice movement. She's actively directing it by serving on the boards of the top groups leading the reform charge. She is on the board of the KIPP Foundation, America's largest charter school organization, which runs 125 schools. One reason KIPP has such reach is that the Walton Family Foundation has pumped over $60 million into it. For a time, Penner sat on the board of the Alliance for School Choice, an advocacy group that not only supports charter schools, but has also backed vouchers. Walton has been by far the largest funder of this group, with grants totaling over $20 million. As well, Penner is on the board of the Charter School Growth Fund, a pivotal player in the charter movement, as mentioned earlier. The Walton Family Foundation has given it over $100 million. Penner is active in several education organizations in California, where she lives, most notably the California Charter Schools Association, which seeks to expand and defend charter schools in America's largest state. The Walton Family Foundation is this group's largest funder by far, with grants totaling over $40 million. Penner has been deeply involved in key charter school fights in California, both as a philanthropist and as a campaign donor. The Walton Family Foundation is helping fund the Broad Foundation's ambitious quest to expand charter schools in Los Angeles, while Penner and her uncle, Jim Walton, have sought to create a more politically friendly climate in L.A. for charters by donating over $1 million for local school board races in 2014 and 2015. Penner's husband, Greg, who is the chairman of Walmart's board, is also immersed in the education world. He previously served as co-chair of the Charter School Growth Fund and is a board member of Teach for America. The Waltons are the single largest funder of Teach for America, with cumulative grants totaling more than $100 million. In late 2015, their foundation announced it would make a $50 million grant to the organization. The Penners are one of the top power couples in education reform circles right now, with huge resources and major clout. They have worked hard to master K-12 issues and make things happen. But make no mistake, Kerry has so much influence over education policy in America because of the family she was born into. Greg has it because of who he married. These private citizens, with such outsized power over public institutions, illustrate the new face of dynastic wealth in America. Get ready for a future with many more philanthropic heirs who operate in the same activist style. There's enough hostility to inherited wealth in America that even some of the nation's richest people see it as a bad thing. But their solution to give away the money turns out to be not much of a solution at all, at least not if you're worried about civic inequities getting baked more deeply into American life amid the disposal of today's historic fortunes. Indeed, as we've seen, leaving a foundation to your kids actually gives them more influence in society than passing down the wealth directly. The fact that many heirs take philanthropy so seriously is good news, and bad news. It's good news in that we're unlikely to see a bunch of empty-headed rich kids giving away billions, or at least this hasn't been the pattern so far. It's bad news in that we're seeing a marked expansion of the kind of sophisticated elite power that so many Americans find unnerving. In this case, though, We're not talking about expert leaders who at least ascend to their influence through quasi-meritocratic systems. We're talking about elites who are born into that power and come to exercise it at considerable expense to U.S. taxpayers who help foot the bill when new family foundations are created. So far, most Americans are unaware of the huge power that heirs are coming to wield through philanthropy, and there has been minimal backlash to this trend. But there has been pushback lately to elites in general, as seen in social movements like the Tea Party and the presidential campaigns of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, not to mention years of polls showing declining public faith in most institutions. One reason so many Americans chafe at being ruled by experts and rich people is the sense that such elites are out of touch with their own life experiences. There's a lot of truth to that. For all their training and expertise, as well as their obvious empathy, people like Emma Bloomberg and Carrie Penner Walton, raised in wealth and privilege, can't possibly understand what it's like to live in certain circumstances. And yet, as philanthropists, they have the ability to powerfully intervene in ordinary people's lives, both in America and around the world. That doesn't seem right in a country founded in opposition to dynastic power, and it doesn't seem sustainable in an America that has often distrusted elite rule. Even if philanthropic heirs use their power wisely much of the time, it's hard to imagine that this situation, if fully understood, will sit well with the American public in a coming future where many more heirs exercise ever-growing influence in society. Chapter 10. The New Medicis. The aviator and industrialist Howard Hughes spent his final years living in a luxurious hotel suite in Acapulco, a recluse who indulged in the heavy use of codeine and Valium. After he died in 1976 on his private plane, fittingly, it was said that Hughes had lost his mind long before. One piece of business Hughes badly bungled in his final years was estate planning. He died without a valid will. This was ironic, since Hughes had created his first will at the young age of 19 in 1925. In it, he stipulated that a portion of his estate go to a medical institute bearing his name. Later, in a bid to outwit the IRS, Hughes formally created such an institute and gave it all the stock of the Hughes Aircraft Company. It was an epic tax dodge, but Hughes's interest in medical science was very real. Both his parents had died from medical problems early in his life, when he was still a teenager, and he himself sustained major injuries in a plane crash in 1946. The charter Hughes signed in 1953, creating the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, HHMI, stated that its purpose was the promotion of human knowledge within the field of the basic sciences, principally the field of medical research and medical education, and the effective application thereof for the benefit of mankind. Hughes reportedly had intended to leave his entire estate to the medical institute, since he had no heirs, but his death without a valid will set off years of litigation, fragmenting his estate among many claimants. Eventually, though, a court ruled that HHMI was at least entitled to all shares of the Hughes Aircraft Company and appointed a group of trustees to oversee the institute. In turn, the board sold the company to General Motors in 1985 for $5.2 billion, which created one of the largest nonprofit endowments in the United States. In the past 30 years, that endowment has more than tripled to over $18 billion. These days, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute employs 2,500 people and gives out over $700 million a year. It makes grants to scientists all over the country from its sprawling brick headquarters in Chevy Chase, Maryland. The institute also hosts hundreds of researchers in the Genelia Research Campus, a vast modern research complex that sits on rolling farmland in Virginia. It features a 900-foot-long arc-shaped laboratory with a design inspired in part by AT&T's fabled Bell Laboratories. Genelia is a mecca for researchers, who are given full funding for 6 years, freeing them from the demands of teaching or chasing grants or ensuring that their research has commercial applications. Their work ranges across areas such as computational neuroscience and structural biology. Janiolia even provides housing and childcare, and there's also a pub on this campus without students. It's a utopia for scientists made possible by a man who's been dead for over 40 years. The Howard Hughes Medical Institute is governed by a small board operating in complete independence from legislative oversight or shareholders. It receives little scrutiny from the media and is beholden to neither a bottom line nor much of a constituency. It is designed to exist in perpetuity, and barring some catastrophe, it is likely to be funding research for centuries to come, growing ever richer and larger in a future where no one remembers who Howard Hughes was. Such is the long arm of philanthropy. J. Paul Getty died the same year that Hughes did, in 1976, also leaving behind a fortune that now powers a fabulously wealthy institution offering a haven to researchers. The Getty Center sits high in the hills overlooking Los Angeles and the ocean. It cost over $1 billion to build, including construction of a train that brings visitors up to an extravagant travertine-encased complex that conjures up the Acropolis in Athens. While the Getty is best known as an art museum, it also houses a research institute dedicated to furthering knowledge and advancing understanding of the visual arts, and a foundation that pumps out millions in grants each year. Backstopping it all is the $12 billion J. Paul Getty Trust, which describes itself as the world's largest cultural and philanthropic organization dedicated to the visual arts. The trust is run by a board of 16 people. This institution, too, is designed to last in perpetuity. Since 2005, its endowment has more than doubled. The Getty Center and the Howard Hughes Medical Institute have long stood out for their enormous resources and large footprint in the arenas in which they operate. But both institutions are becoming less unique as a new wave of wealthy patrons of the arts and sciences arrives on the scene. Not far away from the Getty Center in the Santa Monica Mountains, a think tank is being built, one that its iconoclastic founder, Nicholas Berggruen, has endowed with an initial gift of $500 million. Set on 450 acres, with endless views, the Berggruen Institute will expand its current work of exploring social and political ideas, convening leaders and thinkers from around the world. Berggruen has said that his vision is of a society where people can flourish in harmony with one another. The Institute also works on more prosaic fronts, like reforming dysfunctional governance in California. Berggruen, who made his fortune from investing, has plans to eventually increase the Institute's endowment to $1 billion. That's not big money in science, where research is very expensive, but it's a huge sum for a think tank. Twice the endowment of the Brookings Institution, one of the largest and most influential think tanks in the world. It's yet another reminder of the kind of game-changing wealth that is arriving in philanthropy, including in the most rarefied of arenas. Such wealth is coming to more fields faster and in larger chunks. When J. Paul Getty died 40 years ago, he was among the very richest people in America, with a net worth of $2 billion. The equivalent of $8 billion in 2016. Hughes had a similar net worth. Both men drew enormous attention for fortunes whose size seemed to defy comprehension. Very few other Americans of their time were nearly as rich. When the Forbes 400 list debuted in 1982, it had just 13 billionaires on it. Yet today, neither Getty nor Hughes would rank among the wealthiest 100 Americans. And that top tier of today's super-rich includes quite a few billionaires who have embarked on ambitious projects to shape the realms of culture and science. Consider Alice Walton. In 2011, Walton, long among the top 20 richest Americans with a net worth of over $30 billion, presided over the opening of one of the most expensive new art museums ever built, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas. She'd been interested in art all her life, buying her first painting at the age of 10, a reproduction of Picasso's Blue Nude. Since its founding, Crystal Bridges has amassed a nearly unmatched collection of American art, spending hundreds of millions of dollars of Walton money in an acquisition spree that has roiled art markets. Its prizes include Andy Warhol's Coca-Cola, 3, snatched up for $57 million, and Jimson Weed by Georgia O'Keeffe, bought at Sotheby's in 2014 for $44.4 million. It's not known how much the museum paid for Rosie the Riveter, the classic painting by Norman Rockwell. Crystal Bridges has also ramped up its research and scholarship functions, building the kind of highbrow back-office operation that you'll only find at the world's top museums. It wouldn't be surprising to see grant-making added to the mix. While Crystal Bridges cost around $1.6 billion to build and endow, there is plenty more where that came from. Alice Walton's net worth is 5 times larger than J. Paul Getty's was when he died. Is Alice Walton destined to one day emerge as the biggest arts philanthropist in American history? It's quite possible. Meanwhile, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, hundreds of scientists are pursuing breakthroughs in genomic medicine at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, which sprawls across 3 large buildings. Despite its name, the Broad Institute is actually a freestanding entity with its own governing board that doesn't answer to either MIT or Harvard. Since its founding in 2004, it's pulled in nearly $2 billion in private donations, mostly from its founders, Eli and Edith Broad, and another mega-donor, Ted Stanley, who gave it $650 million in 2014, one of the largest gifts ever for scientific research. Stanley, who made his fortune in collectibles, became interested in biomedical research after his son had a manic episode as a college junior, running through the streets of New York until the police found him naked in a deli. In total, Stanley would give $825 million to the Broad Institute before he died in 2016. Eric Lander, the founding director of the Institute, told the New York Times that these funds had enabled scientists there to make breakthroughs in identifying DNA associated with schizophrenia. Benefactors. Giving like this reflects one of the oldest strains in philanthropy. The wealthy, as benefactors to the creative class, a tradition that long predates government support for the arts and sciences. 50 years ago, the Medici family famously supported Galileo and Leonardo da Vinci. The railroad tycoon John Johnson helped create the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City in 1870. John D. Rockefeller created the Rockefeller Medical Institute in 1901, the first biomedical research center in the United States, and also the University of Chicago. His son, John Jr., underwrote the creation of the Museum of Modern Art, starting in the late 1920s. Still, in terms of scale, there is no comparison between past patronage of the arts and sciences, as well as higher education, and what is happening today. Just as ever more donors are crowding into areas like education or the environment, more are showing up in the arts and sciences, covering the paychecks of molecular biologists, curators, neuroscientists, art conservationists, geneticists, professors holding endowed chairs, and on and on. Pick nearly any disease, and you'll find a deep-pocketed donor who's hot on the trail of a research breakthrough. Name a leading cultural institution, and chances are it's lately received new infusions of cash from billionaire backers. Get lost in a top hospital, and you'll find yourself wandering from one named wing to another. Visit any major university, and it will be hard to find a big building on campus that doesn't bear the name of a mega donor. In some cases, these names have been painted over those of earlier philanthropists, whose gifts, huge at the time, seem rather paltry now. Between 2005 and 2014, a period in which the combined net worth of the Forbes 400 nearly doubled, over 14,000 gifts of $1 million or more were made to colleges and universities. At least 100 of these were worth over $100 million. Health institutions pulled in nearly 5,000 gifts of $1 million or more, with at least 2 topping $500 million. Arts and cultural institutions received 4,000 gifts of $1 million and up each during the same period. One of the largest of these was $400 million to the Dallas Museum of Art, a gift that underscores how today's benefactors are now operating in more places, well outside the usual coastal orbits of yesteryear's wealth elite, even including Bentonville, Arkansas, a city of just 40,000. If you're a neuroscientist, you'll probably find yourself in Seattle at some point, where a brain science institute financed by Paul Allen has grown by leaps and bounds since 2003. If you're a molecular biologist or a geneticist, you may find yourself in Kansas City, Missouri, visiting the Stowers Institute for Medical Research, a huge facility that houses several hundred biomedical scientists. The money behind the institute, some $2 billion, has come from a mutual fund pioneer, Jim Stowers, and his wife, Virginia. Wealthy local donors are also pumping up universities across the heartland. After Harvard and Yale, the University of Texas system has the largest endowment in the United States. The University of Minnesota now has a larger endowment than Brown University, thanks to the rise of new wealth in the upper Midwest. The University of Michigan's endowment is bigger than that of three Ivy League schools. None of this is much of a surprise, given that some 70,000 Americans now have a net worth of $30 million or more, and not all of them live on the East or West coasts. I'll say more in a moment about what today's Medicis are up to, but first, let's consider what's at stake here. We are all affected by the direction of the arts and sciences, as well as of higher education. What cultural work gets valued and shared can shape how we understand the human experience, while the nature of cultural institutions themselves can influence how communities interact and evolve. The impact of science is far more tangible. Which problems researchers are funded to attack can determine which diseases people die from or what breakthrough technologies emerge. Top universities influence what ideas get traction and how tomorrow's leaders think. For a period beginning in the 1950s and 1960s, the United States seemed headed toward a future in which these critical parts of society would be shaped by democratic governance. We wouldn't depend on the munificence and preferences of millionaires to chart scientific and artistic progress or to fund our universities. We'd do it together, as citizens, through public agencies like the National Science Foundation, created in 1950, and the National Endowment for the Arts, created in 1965, or through the great public university systems that were greatly expanded after World War II. Now, that vision is dimming, as governments face new fiscal constraints and as vast resources are mobilized behind an earlier model of private patronage. To be sure, we are still early in this story. In science, even the biggest private funders still deploy minuscule funds compared to what government spends every year. "It's a drop in the bucket," Marilyn Simons told me, talking about the annual grant-making budget of the Simons Foundation, which gave out $230 million in a recent year, compared to the nearly $40 billion that the National Institutes of Health, NIH, and the National Science Foundation, NSF, give annually. Simons is right. Still, signs abound that the locus of influence in science funding is indeed shifting toward private benefactors. The new donors are often supporting younger scientists coming up and getting behind riskier or neglected areas that government agencies won't touch. The choices of philanthropists are increasingly shaping which researchers are able to apply for government funding. In higher education, a torrent of new private money has flooded onto campus during the same period that has seen many states cut spending for public universities, even as academic researchers faced declining federal support. Meanwhile, in the arts, the pendulum has now swung far away from public influence after years of budget cuts to the NEA and state arts agencies. Here, philanthropic dollars dominate the funding landscape, both for individual artists and for arts institutions. As further budget cuts kick in over the coming years and mega-donors step up their giving, the shift toward private financing for scientific exploration, cultural expression, and advanced learning is likely to accelerate. This is not a conscious power grab by the new Medicis, many of whom favor more public funding for the arts, sciences, and higher education. The wealthy can often be found leading the charge to defend the NSF or NEA from deficit hawks. Bill Gates has testified before Congress, calling for more science research funding, while Jim Simons has been a strong proponent of more public investment in math education. In some cases, private donors have stepped forward to write big checks to public universities only after watching in dismay as these institutions were hurt by budget cuts. On the other hand, today's era of austerity didn't come about by accident. It was orchestrated in part by an upper class keen on reducing its taxes, along with the size of government. In some states, cuts to higher education have specifically helped finance tax reductions for the wealthy and corporations. Donors from the far upper class have also underwritten the conservative policy groups that have been whacking away at public support for science and, especially, the arts since the 1980s. The Cato Institute, backed heavily by wealthy libertarians, has long called for the total elimination of government science funding. Scholars at the more moderate American Enterprise Institute, supported by a slew of billionaires, would never go this far, but many advocate sharp cuts in federal spending. Even more influential, as we saw, was Pete Peterson's targeted philanthropy during the early Obama years to help move deficit reduction to the top of the national agenda. As a result of the Budget Control Act of 2011, government-funded scientific research through the NIH and the NSF will be on a downward slide for years to come. Veteran scientists have described the cuts so far as devastating. Further cuts lie ahead. For its part, the NEA has never recovered from earlier attacks when some Republicans, including President Reagan, worked to eliminate all government funding of the arts, a position championed by the Heritage Foundation and its wealthy donors. Heritage has kept up the attack on the NEA for over three decades now, publishing dozens of policy briefs attacking its funding. If the NEA's budget had kept pace with inflation since 1981, it would now be over $400 million a year. Instead, in 2016, Congress appropriated just under $150 million to the NEA. State arts funding has also been in decline in many places, especially in California. A web of right-wing think tanks in the states, modeled on Heritage and Cato, has been at the forefront of attacking local arts funding. Cutting such spending, for example, has been among the priorities of the North Carolina policy groups backed by Art Pope. Following the political revolution engineered by Pope in 2010, government funding for the arts in North Carolina fell sharply. Many of the billionaires who underwrite efforts to reduce taxes and government also are big donors to the arts and biomedical research. Some, like David Koch, are libertarians who believe as a matter of doctrine that government shouldn't be involved in funding such research. Others, like Bruce Kovner, may take a softer stance, but nevertheless favor fiscal policies that virtually guarantee cuts to the arts, science, and higher education. Hedge fund billionaires like Kovner or Kenneth Griffin get lots of praise when they write big checks to arts institutions. Kovner is the biggest donor ever to the Juilliard School of Music. But few observers connect the dots and realize that some of these same figures have been writing checks for years to groups and politicians that seek to downsize government, including spending for the arts. To be sure, quite a few wealthy people have been on the other side of this debate, financing think tanks and democratic politicians who have pushed for higher taxes on the wealthy and a more robust government. But in recent decades, the overall weight of the donor class has been behind a fiscal conservatism that has left government with diminishing discretionary cash. Critics of the public sector often argue that it has usurped roles that are better played by civil society, pointing out that philanthropy accomplished plenty of good before the era of big government. The Metropolitan Museum is just one of philanthropy's greatest hits prior to the New Deal and the Great Society. Advanced medical research centers, great museums, top universities, you could find all these institutions a century ago when Washington, D.C. was still a sleepy southern city that commanded just a small sliver of the nation's GDP. What's so wrong with a shift back to a time when nonprofits, as opposed to public agencies, charted the direction of culture, science, and higher learning? Also, as a practical matter, with government short on cash and vision, shouldn't we be celebrating the arrival of new donors who can fill the vacuum? Haven't these generous benefactors come along just in the nick of time? Indeed, they have, and many are doing great things. But it's important to keep in mind the backstory of why private philanthropists and their money now loom so much larger. What's happening in the cultural and scientific realms tracks with what's happening in other areas like education and public parks. As the great 20th century tide of public money recedes in an era in which big government is dead, as Bill Clinton famously declared, a new tide of private money is flowing in, heralded by headlines about huge gifts to hospitals, museums, universities, and research centers. Most of the donors behind these gifts simply want to do some good in the world. For every donor like David Geffen, who gave $100 million to Lincoln Center in 2015, in what struck many as a naked bid for status, there are many others who would just as soon duck the spotlight. In fact, since 2005, there have been at least 10 philanthropic gifts of $100 million or more that have been made anonymously. Yet whatever their motives or their humility, donors do get something for their money, beyond mere satisfaction. They get influence over our culture, along with the arc of progress. And as the United States shifts back toward an earlier model of achieving big things, where civil society takes more of the lead, that influence is growing. Maybe in earlier times one could talk about ordinary people driving civil society forward. Now, it's the givers who are the main drivers, and that's especially true in the rarefied realms of the arts, science, and higher learning. In short, what we have here is another complicated story about philanthropy and influence in a new gilded age. It's hard not to be inspired by the vision and achievements of many donors, and equally hard not to be troubled by the bigger picture of more power shifting into private hands. Knowledge Quest. The Simons Foundation exemplifies the pace and scale of today's new philanthropy. In just over a decade, it has emerged as one of the leading private funders of basic science in the United States, pushing forward the frontiers of knowledge about mathematics, physics, the life sciences, and more. The Manhattan-based foundation has also revolutionized autism research, spending hundreds of millions of dollars to draw new talent into a once-neglected field and helping orchestrate a series of breakthroughs on a condition that afflicts millions. These are big accomplishments for a foundation that for many years was no more than a filing box in the dressing room of Marilyn Simons, the second wife of hedge fund billionaire Jim Simons. Jim got his Ph.D. in mathematics and then worked in the defense sector in Washington before pursuing a successful academic career. He became the chair of the math department at SUNY Stony Brook and in 1976 won the prestigious Oswald Veblen Prize in Geometry. His career took yet another turn when he started his hedge fund, Renaissance Technologies, in 1982. There, Simons and his teams created mathematical models to predict the behavior of financial markets. The firm was phenomenally successful. For a 20-year period, from 1994 through mid-2014, Renaissance averaged a 71.8% annual return. In some of those years, Simons personally made over $1 billion. Eventually, his net worth climbed to over $10 billion, and it has kept growing. Jim and Marilyn started their foundation in December 1994. "We had always given to charity since I had any money to give away," Jim told me. The Simonses usually made those gifts around the holidays. Marilyn had the idea of formalizing things with a foundation, which was seeded with an initial gift of $1 million. In 2001, Marilyn, who'd gotten a Ph.D. in economics but never went into academia, rented a small office down the street from Gramercy Park and hired a few part-time staff. Still, the foundation was a pretty informal operation, and mostly it operated passively, fielding requests for money. "They were coming to us," said Jim. "We didn't sit around and say, 'Oh, why don't we do X or Y or Z?' We were being reactive." Then, one day, Marilyn recalled, Jim had an idea. "We should give to things we want to give to." That basic insight led the Simonses to think more carefully about where they might give money, and to start building a real foundation. Their main interests were math and science, but they were also keen on doing something about autism and learning disabilities. They pulled together a round table of experts for a day to learn about the research in this area. Jim said of that meeting, "We came away with the conclusion that there were two things we could do. One, bring better people into the field because the quality of the research was not all that good, and two, to focus at least initially on genetics, where it was clear that this was caused at least in part by one's genes." The Simons Foundation made a few grants along these lines, but felt out of their depth when giving out money at this level. "We were lucky we picked a couple good people to support, but we really didn't know how to do that," Jim said. So he and Marilyn looked around for someone to help them, and soon hooked up with Gerald Fishbach, a neuroscientist who had spent years at NIH and also two medical schools before becoming a dean at Columbia, where he continued advanced research. In 2006, he joined the Simons Foundation as the scientific director overseeing its autism research funding. It's worth pausing here to point out that top foundation jobs can be very attractive, especially to academics or nonprofit executives who get tired of always hustling for grants. Moving to the other side of the funding game can be a nice break, not to mention hugely empowering, since now you're the one waving the magic funding wand to bring new projects to life. And it's all the better if you're getting in on the ground floor of a billionaire's young foundation. The appeal of these jobs means that donors can easily recruit first-tier talent to advance their philanthropic dreams, in effect, building private brain trusts, a powerful asset in a society where expertise is a key currency of influence. "Hiring Fishbach was a paradigm shift," said Jim Simons, "because he introduced these methods of learning about the field, learning about the investigators, opening up an application process and reviewing." The Simonses were so thrilled with this step forward that they decided to also professionalize their giving for basic math and science, which had tended to be haphazard as well. Within a few years, the Simons Foundation had top directors building up all its grant-making areas. As the operation evolved, Marilyn stayed on as president, leading the work to scale up an outfit that soon occupied several floors in a lower Fifth Avenue office building not far from Madison Square Park. Along the way, the couple moved ever bigger chunks of money into the foundation's endowment, which had risen above $2 billion by 2013. Annual grant-making soared too, and even doubled in some years. "It just grew," Jim said. Many new philanthropists these days are reluctant to build large foundations, fretting about the overhead costs and the dreaded thought of their philanthropy becoming bureaucratic. Jim and Marilyn Simons never had any doubt about the need to hire a sizable staff. "What we're doing is very technical," Jim said. "You can't just give money to mathematics by throwing it out on the street and letting the mathematicians pick it up. You need to know who's doing what, how good they are, what's the likelihood they will use the money wisely, and so on. We're giving a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars every year, so we want to do it in a professional way." The Simons Foundation grew even larger in 2016. When it took over an 11-story building near its headquarters and began populating the new space with several hundred researchers working in-house at a new operation called the Flatiron Institute. Like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the Simons Foundation is embracing a hybrid model of making millions of dollars in grants while also providing a cushy home for researchers. In time, Simons may well rival HHMI in size and influence. Jim and Marilyn Simons said in their giving pledge letter that the great majority of our wealth will be devoted to philanthropic purposes. As of 2016, the combined assets in their foundation and private investments totaled around $18 billion. In March 2014, the New York Times published a front-page article ominously headlined, "Billionaires with Big Ideas Are Privatizing America."